Maine women who played a pivotal role in securing the right for women to vote. 100 years ago, right now, activists in Maine were gearing up for a vote they had been lobbying for years. In 1917, they had finally secured a referendum to amend the Maine Constitution to allow full suffrage for women. Then in April, the U.S. entered World War I, and it became difficult for suffragists to organize and rally support around their cause. In September of 1917, the referendum failed. Only men voted, of course, and Maine women would not secure the right to vote until 1920, when the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution went into effect. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will discuss two of the Maine women who led the charge 100 years ago, and about women's political role and power today. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. January's Women's March on Washington was the latest in a long tradition of women's protests and activism in the U.S. A century ago, suffragists were taking to the streets of Washington and other American cities, fighting for a woman's right to vote. Today on Maine Calling, we'll discuss some of the leaders of Maine's suffragist movement and their relevance today. What are the issues that have prompted a resurgence of political and social activism among women throughout the country? In the studio with me, Eliza Townsend. She is executive director of the Maine Women's Lobby. Anne Gass is the author of Voting Down the Rose, Florence Brooks Whitehouse, and Maine's Fight for Women's Suffrage. And joining us from our Bangor studio, Rhea Cody Robbins. She is director of the Franco-American Women's Institute. As always, we want to hear from you. Just how much do you know about the role Maine women played in securing voting rights? What do you think are the most important issues for women today? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Thank you all for being here doing research for this program, Eliza. I came across the fact that it was exactly 100 years ago today that Maine voters were facing a referendum about the Maine women's right to vote. It's interesting to me that it was voted down at the time. And this was after years and years and years of work. I mean, we're talking about the famous suffragist, you know, Elizabeth Cady Stanton. You know, we're talking the mid-1800s. So what are the lessons, do you believe, from the suffragist movement for today's activists?
I think the lessons I take are that change is possible, but it has never, ever come without a fight. We have to engage, we have to work at a grassroots level, get out and explain to people what the challenges are that we face, spread the word. We, of course, have more technology and better ability to do that today than the suffragettes did, but we still face the same challenges of an acceptance of the status quo.
Acceptance of the status quo, that people fight to hold on to the status quo.
Unfortunately, yes.
All right. Well, Anne, thanks so much for being here. I want to ask you a little bit about your story because you wrote a book about your great-grandmother.
Yeah, that's right.
Tell me about your great-grandmother. Who was she and why is she so important, do you believe, for us to know about her?
So Florence was born in Augusta in 1869, but after she married in the 1890s, she moved with her husband to Portland and lived there for the rest of her life. She came late to suffrage. She was in her 40s when she started being a suffrage activist and quickly became a leader in the suffrage movement in Maine. She worked with the famous suffrage national suffrage leaders, Carrie Chapman Catt and Alice Paul, in the two different national suffrage organizations. And what I found particularly compelling about her when I started researching her was that she had been written out of Maine suffrage history because she was considered to be too radical because she had picketed the president and supported women who did things like burn him in effigy in Washington and things like that. So she was bucking not only Maine society's thoughts about the way women should behave and whether or not they should vote, but just sort of general rules of decorum and how women should be active.
And I understand her husband was someone who might be described as a feminist in today's language.
Yeah, that was one of the really great stories. Is he actually, his father-in-law, who had been Chief Justice of the Maine Supreme Court, William Penn Whitehouse, started the tradition by being active in suffrage movement in the 1870s. And then later on, around 1914, her husband, Robert, started something called the Men's Equal Suffrage League. And he served as its chair. And its sole purpose was to first get that statewide suffrage referendum in 1917 underway, and then to support suffrage going forward. He and Florence put about $1,000 of their own money into the 1917 referendum campaign, which is about $24,000 in 2016 or 2017 money. So, you know, it was quite a bit of cash at a time when they were also, you know, involved in the war effort.
I want to turn to you, Rhea, in Bangor. You write about Camille Lessard Bissonnette. Who is Camille Bissonnette, and why do you believe she's important for the rest of us to know about?
Well, I'm a student of her work, and also Janet Scheidler is her biographer. But with Camille, I think in regard to today, what's important is that she was an immigrant, and so that she would shine, you know, through her works, even if you read her book, Canuck, today, and her journalism, which she started out with Le Messager in Lewiston, you would read issues, I think, that are pertinent to immigrants to today. She started out as a teacher at age 16 in 1899 in Quebec, and at age 21 immigrated in 1904 to Lewiston and worked in the Continental Mill. Le Messager asked for correspondence to write columns, and she started doing that in 1906.
Let me stop. Is Le Messager, is that a newspaper of the time in Quebec?
Yes.
Okay. She's writing.
That was, no.
No, no. Tell me what
that
it is.
It's a French language newspaper that existed until the 60s in Lewiston, Maine.
Okay. So she was writing a column for, okay, go on. Pick it up from there.
And then, so in 1908, she's writing columns for Les Filles du Moulin, and the dates for her in terms of the suffrage is 1910. She gave a public talk and gave several points as to why the women had the vote. So she was early on the campaign. She gave this talk in Lewiston, Maine, and there was a man, Monsieur Poulain, who was also gave the talk. And here she was writing for Le Messager. Her talk was recreated in the newspaper on page 2, but his was 3 days later published on the front page with a picture and a bio and calling his column the Valiant. But by 1917, Le Messager, which was the French language newspaper in Lewiston, had changed their position, and they were writing pro the vote. But unfortunately, the French population in Maine did not listen, and they voted highest against the vote. They were 10 to 1. And my ward in Waterville was one of the highest to oppose. But fortunately, the women did get the vote.
So isn't that interesting that immigrant women 100 years ago, is it because they were more traditional? Is it because they didn't want to make waves in their new country? Why do you believe that the Camille was unusual for the immigrant women and that the vote went the other way? Or is it because it was only men voting?
Well, that could be a piece of it, the men voting, but there was a bicultural, bilingual, bi-border conversation. She was in correspondence with the women in Quebec, and they were very much that the church played into the women not getting the vote in Quebec. And in the interesting part for the immigrant piece, I guess, is that she had at first, you know, was faithful to, you know, Quebec, but then she acculturated to the U.S. society, and she saw the benefits of, you know, the vote. And so she, I think, was a maverick to begin with, that she was teaching at age 16, that she was writing at such a young age, for journalism, which she did for 30 years for Le Messager. And in her book, she really looks at, and you can read that in translation. She originally wrote in French, but you can read it in English. It's in an anthology, Canuck and Other Stories. She really looks at domestic violence. She looks at women's independence and, you know, and having their paycheck. So she had these ideas at a very young age.
Eliza,
so I think that she was unusual.
Yeah, and all of these women were unusual and unusually courageous. Yes.
Yes, absolutely. At a time when not only were women not valued and allowed the same rights as other citizens, but it was doubly hard for immigrants.
Eliza, we're having this conversation on Equal Pay Day. Tell me what Equal Pay Day is and why it's relevant to the conversation today.
It sure is relevant. Today marks the day when the average white woman, I have to point out this is the day affecting white women, not women of color, would have to work to earn at least as much as her counterpart, her male counterpart, did last year. So 4 months into the new year is what it takes to come up to the same amount that her male counterpart earned last year. For African American women, Equal Pay Day falls in August. So it's, as we've heard across the country, the average pay gap puts women at 79% of men. Economic security is the overarching issue that affects women here in Maine as well as in other places. 1 in 7 American women lives in poverty. And those rates are troublingly high, especially here in Maine, among women over 65 and women who are the single householder, the head of household with children under the age of 5. So the ramifications go far beyond their own personal experience and conditions, but it means that we are allowing children to live in poverty. 1 in 4 children under the age of 5 in Maine is living in poverty with lifelong impacts. It affects health. It affects the ability to learn. It affects one's ability to become a contributing member of society.
Why is this a women's issue and not an everybody issue?
It is an everybody issue, but it's disproportionately women who are living in poverty, I'm sad to say.
Anne, you're nodding. I want to ask how you connect what you've learned about your great-grandmother to the issues that Eliza's talking about right here.
Yeah, that's a great question. I started out not really knowing anything about suffrage history, and so that was all a revelation. And to understand what Florence did, I had to not only read a lot of her correspondence and papers, but read a lot of suffrage history. And so I came to have a real appreciation for what the women struggled against and how long they struggled. Because really, although the 1848 Seneca Falls Convention that you alluded to, that Elizabeth Cady Stanton called with her friends, is often cited as the sort of starting point of the suffrage movement in America, Abigail Adams was bugging her husband about it back in 1776.
Do not forget the women.
That's right. And the end part of her paragraph to him is, you know, remember that all men would be tyrants if you allowed them to be, or something to that effect. So, I mean, very serious. And that, so from the country's founding, women had been concerned about this. But going forward, in 2015, I took a road trip from San Francisco to D.C. following the route of these women's suffrage activists in 1915. So it had been 100 years before. And they were bringing a petition to Congress and the president demanding an amendment to the U.S. Constitution enfranchising women. So I followed their route. And along the way, I stopped and interviewed women's rights activists and leagues of women voters and that kind of thing, to find out what had changed and what hadn't in 100 years. And that's when I just viscerally understood how hard it had been for women to get every right that we've achieved and what a battle it was and how precarious it is still, in part because the only constitutional right that we have is the right to vote. Everything else is in statute or regulation and can be removed at some points with a stroke of a pen. I mean, an executive order that can be issued by the president that changes a lot of things for a lot of women, and there's no real debate about that. So, I feel like that's helped me understand that when women talk about their rights and how important they are, they're not just being paranoid. This is a long-standing conversation, and it's just still continuing today.
Rhea, I want to ask you, you mentioned that Camille Bissonnette wrote a great deal about the immigrant community she was living in, and I'm wondering where you believe her thinking, her philosophy relates to the conversation addressing immigrants' lives today, and especially women immigrants' lives.
Well, I think that is probably the thing you've hit, right? You know, the point, because usually when you look at cultural work, sometimes the general culture does not touch on women's lives and the issues specific to women's lives. And I think you need someone with a voice like Camille, you know, like the Franco-American Women's Institute also, you know, celebrated the 20th anniversary, and we put out a book of anthology of the Franco-American women's lives, Heliotrope, French Heritage Women Create. And I think that when the immigrant speaks from the experience, there is a sense of the authentic self in that they experienced the, you know, whatever it is that they have gone through. And it's interesting that you mention, you know, the anniversary and, you know, the Equal Pay Day, because in 1910, when Camille made her speech, there were 11 points that I counted in her speech, and they are touching on issues which we are still talking about today.
What are some of those points?
Well, she says that that the equal education and equal employment opportunities was part of the reasoning that the women vote would be important, and also that they would bring a fresh perspective coming from the outside. She says that the women were capable of being discerning in their vote and would actually have something to say, because they were the primary educators of the children, and that she said that, you know, women were taxed, but they were not getting the right to vote. I mean, she had several points. And I think when you're talking about the fact that she was writing in French, she's writing to the cultural women here in Maine, but she's also talking to the women in Quebec. And Quebec did not get the vote until 1940. All of Canada got the vote, but Quebec did not. And if you want to take it even back further, France was 1945. So I think that there is a sense within the French cultural community of women not having the vote and the voice. So in actuality, the immigrants voting with their feet coming here to the U.S., like today when you have immigrants, there are rights that they gain, which they do not have in their original countries.
Let me make sure I'm understanding you correctly, Rhea. Even though women got the vote through the 19th Amendment in the United States in 1920, in Canada not mm-hmm. till 1940, in Quebec not till 1945?
No. Canada received the vote early, as the U.S., but Quebec, the sole province, only gave the women the right to vote in 1940. And I'm comparing that to France, which got the vote in 1945. And so if I'm looking at the French as a, you know, a cultural body, even though there was immigration from France to Canada and then Canada to the U.S., the women in the U.S. received the vote in 1920.
Wow. And
so
something
that is the part.
And something relevant, one of our listeners, Rebecca, wanted to point out that the Passamaquoddy and other Indians did not get the right to vote until 1954. On that note, we do have to take a break. If you'd like to join the conversation, we'd love to hear from you. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566, send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Goodwin's Volvo in Topsom, where the all-new V90 Cross Country is available to view and drive. Learn more at goodwinsvolvo.com. And the Country Inn at Camden Rockport, offering family-friendly lodging in Midcoast Maine with 36 suites and 11 cottages, countryinmaine.com. Maine Public Radio strives to bring you news, information, and public affairs which provide a better understanding of ideas, events, and cultures around the world. The BBC has been a valued addition to our schedule in recent years, adding a comprehensive and global perspective to our news mix. Comprehensive BBC coverage can be heard during the overnights starting at midnight and running until 6 a.m. Maine Public Radio brings you the world courtesy of the BBC, exploring important issues and learning what the world is thinking, saying, and doing. BBC Overnights here on Maine Public Radio. Do you value and appreciate public broadcasting? Lend your voice in support of this valued service. Participate in our I Love Maine Public testimonial campaign designed to raise awareness of what Maine Public means to Maine and its citizens. You can be a big part of this initiative, and all it takes is a minute of your time. We have an I Love Maine Public hotline, photo opportunities, and a written and verbal testimonial vault. There are any number of fun ways for you to join in. Please go to mainepublic.org to see all the ways that you can participate. Thank you.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Maine women and their role in voting rights and current issues. In the studio with me, Ann Gass is the author of Voting Down the Rose, Florence Brooks Whitehouse and Maine's Fight for Women's Suffrage. Eliza Townsend is executive director of the Maine Women's Lobby. And joining us from our Bangor studio, Rhea Cody Robbins, director of the Franco-American Women's Institute. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. On the line with us now, Posey Cowan. She is one of the founders of Equal Rights Maine, a grassroots group advocating for an equal rights amendment in the U.S. Constitution and for one in Maine's Constitution. Posey, welcome to Maine Calling.
Thank you very much, and I'm really enjoying the conversation that you all have had so far, and it's very exciting to be able to say that there's a lot going on with the Equal Rights Amendment for the state of Maine. And in fact, on Thursday, there's going to be a judiciary committee hearing about it at 1 o'clock at the State House. We have two legislators, Senator Eloise Vitelli and Representative Louise Rickert, who have sponsored this legislation. And there are many women's organizations that are supporting this, obviously, and we are hoping that there's going to be a big turnout.
So why do we need the Equal Rights Amendment now?
Are you speaking about Maine specifically or in general?
How about both?
Okay, well, let's start with Maine, since that's what's happening this week. It's important for Maine because most people believe that women should have equal rights. And there's nothing in the state constitution that specifically says that. So that without the language, we're at risk for things, laws being interpreted that are not for women. And we are hoping and really feel that Maine should join the other 23 states that already have equal language in their state constitution.
What would it take to have a Maine state ERA amendment to the Constitution?
That's a good question. It takes two-thirds of the Senate, state Senate, to vote for it, and two-thirds of the House, and then it goes out to referendum and has to be voted on. What's interesting and surprising to me is that there was a vote in 2015 and it was voted down. So obviously there's a lot of work that has to be done to get this even out to the referendum. And what the sponsors are asking is for people to call their state senators and reps right now in the next 2 weeks to say that they really want their representatives to support this bill, because as the judiciary, as it goes into working committee, the bill, after the hearing, it's important for all the legislators to be sort of saying to each other, we're getting all these calls that the voters really support and want us to vote for equal rights, and that impacts a lot of the committee hearing as well as the working committee, as well as when the actual vote is done. So it's an exciting time, and we hope that we'll get a lot of support by the public to move it forward.
Okay, and I want to relate this to the National Equal Rights Amendment movement. When I was a girl, this was the big news. Do you think many people realize that the Equal Rights Amendment never passed?
No, right. Most people, there are different polls that say that about 80% of Americans think that there is an Equal Rights Amendment in our Constitution. And I think part of the confusion was that even though Congress passed it, it went out to the states to ratify, and they needed 38, and they only got 35. And they put a time limit on it, then it was extended, and then the time limit, they didn't extend it again. So there is a misconception in the public that people think it's already in. I actually thought it was already in until about 15 years ago. There are a number of my contemporaries in our 60s and 70s, even though we were alive at that time, and some even active, but not all, really thought it was in there. So part of our group, Equal Rights Maine, is to inform the public and really let them know. And also, most Americans believe that women should be treated equally. And one of the things that we discovered was when we've been talking to some of the staffers of our reps and senators, some of the younger staffers have never heard of the Equal Rights Amendment.
Well, Posey, thanks so much for joining us today. Posey Cowan is one of the founders of Equal Rights Maine. Eliza, do we need an Equal Rights Amendment now? It has, you know, aren't non-discrimination laws taking care of the kinds of things we were hoping to take care of in the 1970s with the Equal Rights Amendment?
Well, we certainly hope that the existing laws will remain in place. I think Posey's point is that they can be repealed by any legislature, any elected body. And as we have seen over the past few years and months, our elected officials do not always make decisions that are in the best interest of women and the rest of their constituents. So we'll be there on Thursday to testify in support. In the meantime, we, over the intervening decades and consistently now, continue to work on individual laws and policies, rules to improve life for women.
Okay, on the line with us now, Ann Luther, who is treasurer of the League of Women Voters in Maine. Hi, Ann.
Hello, Jennifer. Thanks for having me on.
So, League of Women Voters, how far back does your organization? Most people have heard of the League of Women Voters, know that you put on debates and symposia and put out great information around election time. But what's the history? Were you suffragists way back when?
Yeah, we were. And it's so interesting listening to the conversation and the shared history that all of us in our heritage share. The League of Women Voters was formed from the National American Woman Suffrage Association at the very year that the 19th Amendment passed. So the League of Women Voters under that name has been operating for almost 100 years. But the organization from which we were born had been working for 75 or 50 years before that to get women the right to vote. So these struggles go back a long way. And listening to the conversation, you know, sometimes the biggest reforms are the ones that you have to fight to keep the hardest. And as we've watched suffrage in the United States become more and more nearly universal over the course of time, we find that even though we all have the right to vote, some of us are having a hard time still holding on to that right. And even though we may have the right to vote, we are not all guaranteed equal representation, as money in politics tends to favor the wealthy over the less wealthy. And so helping people get equal representation, even when they have an equal right to vote, is a struggle to this day.
And I know that the League of Women Voters is nonpartisan. So what are the priority issues for the League of Women Voters in Maine today?
Well, it's still voting rights. You know, we still want everybody to be able to overcome barriers to voting. We want to fight against barriers to voting. We want everybody to be able to exercise their franchise. So we work for things that make voting easier and against things that make voting harder. And we also work on money in politics to make sure that equal votes translates into equal representation. So those are a couple of our high priorities right now. We're also very active on the ranked choice voting campaign.
Well, Anne, thanks so much for joining us. Anne Luther, the treasurer of the League of Women Voters in Maine. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566, our email address talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. I have an email here, if I can find it in front of me. This is from Representative Kim Monahan in Cape Elizabeth. She says, my family grew up in the former home of a well-known women's activist then known as a suffragette. Her name was Maud Wood Park, was originally from Boston. She was a graduate from Radcliffe College. She toured colleges promoting rights for women, the right to vote, and campaigning for the 19th Amendment. She was the youngest member of the National American Women's Suffrage Association and later became president of the League of Women Voters, remaining there till 1924. Looking for healthy living and fresh air, she came to Maine, bought a plot of land in Cape Elizabeth, and built a cottage overlooking the entrance to Casco Bay. And then she goes on to say, I guess you could say Ms. Wood's activism left some impressions on our home, where we lived for over 40 years. My mother was very active in volunteering and defending the rights of children. My sister, Stephanie, was in the first women's graduating class at Bowdoin College in 1975. And I've spent over 25 years in public service, always proud to have supported the rights of women, young and older, in all aspects. Thank you, Kim, for Representative Monahan, for writing in. And do you feel as though you were changed by the spirit of your great-grandmother, you know, when you were investigating her role in the women's movement?
Yeah, I did, actually. I mean, because growing up, I knew nothing about her, other than I knew that she was a novelist and an artist, because we had her books and her paintings, but we and I knew that she was a suffragist, that and that she had sort of marched on Washington, but that was always said with a kind of a curl of the lip, you know, a little bit of a condescending sneer. Oh, she just like made she made trouble, but I sort of stupidly as a child that really didn't perk, you know, my interest until later on when my aunt had several boxes of her papers that she'd preserved and ended up donating them to the Maine Historical Society where they are now. And I started reading through them and began piecing together, you know, in fact, what an incredible leader she was. And one of the reasons why I wrote the book was I felt as though when I was growing up, I could have used, you know, there were times like when I was a teenager, I could have really used knowing that I had a very cool great-grandmother like this. And also just knowing more about women's history and the women's rights movement. I think that's critical for kids today to know.
Rhea, is the influence of Camille Bissonnette and others you research affected the way you live your life?
Oh, hugely. I'm trying, you know, I was reminded, I want to go back to the comment of the Native Americans getting the vote in 1954. My grandson reminded me of that this morning as I was getting ready to leave. So I think that the thing that is unique to Maine is one of the things that I find Camille's contribution, not only the fact that we have a written record of her works in the newspaper's archives, Le Messager, but that, you know, she was writing in French and having this conversation across the border. I think the thing about Maine and having the knowledge of what is unique here to Maine, in that we do have these other diversities and, you know, their contributions over the years. And I think for my own work, my own writing and research, delving into the Franco-American women's lives, well, I'm gone to the description of French heritage because I'm being inclusive and being a literature person, wanting to include that in my work. But I think that Camille's book, Canuck, which a lot of people sometimes have a difficulty with the title, but it was kind of like she was reclaiming that term, what new immigrants, because there were waves of the French people coming to Maine, coming to the, you know, to the Northeast. And I think within the book itself, she looks at the reception of, say, people who had immigrated earlier to those who came, you know, at a later date, and the difficult psychology and the complex issues of being an immigrant. And in that time frame that she's writing that, long before I think that there was a raised consciousness about those issues in the public space, she's bringing those up. So I have been deeply affected by her contributions. But the fact that she's a suffragist and that, well, Anne and I are working on a forthcoming exhibit. We're on the committee with the Maine State Museum. And it, I think it's really important that the French woman, Camille, be part of that exhibit. For the, you know, the French population, the Franco-American population here in the state of Maine, and showing, you know, that we belong, you know, we are here, and that, you know, feeling very proud of what she did.
Great. I'm going to try to get in one more call before our break. We're going to go to Ellery in Waterville. Hi, Ellery. Go ahead.
Yes. Thank you for taking my call. I have a sort of a general question. I'm totally in favor of equal rights, equal pay. I mean, long, long overdue. My concern is that of the things I've been reading lately of single parents, mostly ladies, ladies as in boss positions, in CFO and CEO positions. I'm hearing more about stresses, emotional stresses and tolls, and whether there's sufficient planning and support services for these advances which are happening so very quickly. And I'm wondering if folks are, ladies specifically, are prepared for the responsibilities of so many of these advantages that hopefully will come soon.
Eliza?
All people who work need to struggle to balance their responsibilities at home and at work. That's why we are big advocates of a system of paid family leave so that we can meet our responsibilities. We also are huge advocates of affordable, high-quality child care so that we can balance our responsibilities. There is no reason that those responsibilities should fall strictly on women or ladies. They are the responsibility of all parents, but we need systems. Our country is unique in leaving individual families to figure these challenges out one by one. Each of us, as we decide to have children, goes through the process of figuring out what we're going to do for childcare, how we're going to afford it, who's going to take time, who's going to stay home, who's going to do the shuttle every afternoon, who's going to deliver the child to childcare in the morning, et cetera. There's no need that we should put that burden on families and on women in particular. In other situations, we have looked at challenges and created societal solutions. We build roads so that we can all drive on them. We created public schools so that we can all educate our children. We can, in fact, build systems that support all people and not just women.
Ellery, thanks so much for your call. We do have to take another quick break. When we come back, more of your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Halcyon Yarn, offering natural fibers, yarns, and classes in historic downtown Bath since 1971. Learn more at halcyonyarn.com.
Amy Mann made new wave music in the 80s with her group Till Tuesday, and she went solo in the 90s. Today, her songs are about people going through tough stuff.
Internal struggles are just very interesting, and I have a lot of compassion for how difficult it can be. There's a
simple fix. I'm Kelly McEvers, Amy Mann's latest album, Mental Illness, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
And join us for All Things Considered coming up this afternoon at 4. And join us at 2 o'clock following Maine Calling for The Shadow of Charm City. Ideas will take us to Baltimore, once named Charm City. It's now often known as a war zone due to racial tensions. That's Ideas from the CBC coming up after Maine Calling here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling today on the program Social and Political Activism by Maine Women. In the studio with me, Eliza Townsend, the executive director of the Maine Women's Lobby. Anne Gass is author of Voting Down the Rose, Florence Brooks Whitehouse and Maine's Fight for Woman Suffrage. And joining us from our Bangor studio, Rhea Cody Robbins, director of the Franco-American Women's Institute. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. An email from Kevin. I am the father of three daughters, and I wonder what makes women vote against my daughters' rights and their own self-interest. Is it demonization of women with power, weak men? Anne?
Yeah, that's such an interesting question because, you know, certainly the suffragists 100 years ago were asking that same question. I mean, why would you, as a woman, vote against your own sex and your the rights that they have? But there were women then who believed that men took, you know, enough care of women, so they didn't need the vote. And that women weren't strong enough or smart enough to vote. So nowadays, I think that women still believe that they have it pretty good. You know, they're happy. Like we said at the start of the show, you know, the status quo is okay. And really, you know, women should just stop whining. And there is still a percentage of women who think that women do belong in the home and they shouldn't be out in the workforce and doing their own thing.
Rhea, do you want to respond as well?
Well, you know, I'm thinking that, you know, the arguments against women getting the votes back, you know, at the time when Camille was, you know, putting forth her reasons why to get the vote, the person that she was, well, I think it was set up as a debate at this location in Lewiston in 1910. One of the things that was often brought up was the purity of women and that they would be sullied by, you know, getting the vote. And Camille said, absolutely not, that, you know, you're not going to say that because the women themselves are, you know, in charge of who they are and, you know, they wouldn't be swayed. And I think one of the other things that, you know, which is kind of ridiculous was brought up is, you know, in the women in Britain, you know, the violence was you know, brought against the women themselves. And Camille said, well, that was the very thing that made me recognize the fact of this whole debate. And so, you know, what was brought as an argument against, I mean, she had some very, very good reasons why. But I think where the women did not get the vote, say, in Quebec until 1940, the women do tend to sometimes not understand, I think. And the ERA was the same thing back in the 70s because I was of voting age then. There's always a, you know, something which comes up in the media which kind of, you know, sidetracks the real agenda. So, yes, I agree. And, you know, maybe that with my other, you know, continuing my other point is that this, you know, being taught in the schools to say, like my grandson, who's a freshman at Borough High School, knowing this, you know, these details, I think it's important to be taught.
We're going to go to Westbrook and Constantino. Hi, Constantino. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi, Jennifer. How are you today?
Great.
Excellent. My question is, during the campaign, we had a, you know, who's our president, a man who called women pigs and dogs and basically made fun of the way Carly Fiorina looked, bragged about his sexual exploits in front of young adults and our children. And now as president, is trying to defund Planned Parenthood and wants to nominate somebody for the Supreme Court who will promptly go to work on Roe v. Wade. So how is the status of women's rights or indeed human rights these days?
It's at risk.
Yeah,
And I think that's why we saw such turnout in January at the women's marches. I was in Augusta. The organizers are estimating that there were 10,000 people there. I don't know if that's accurate, but it was certainly more people than I've ever seen turn out in any one place. The numbers were enormous here in Portland. We saw that the numbers were enormous in Washington, D.C., and that the reaction was worldwide. So our rights are fragile. I think we've had a recognition by women, and particularly I'm seeing young women who at one point perhaps thought that we didn't need an ERA, that our rights were accomplished, and that they didn't need to pay attention to be closely following development in politics or worrying, are recognizing that our rights are fragile. I saw a Facebook nugget. I have no proof of this, but I read today that 86% of the phone calls being made to our elected representatives are coming from women. We're seeing that increased level of engagement among our membership. I know that Planned Parenthood is seeing the
Absolutely.
Same. The turnout at events, whether it's for something organized by the American Civil Liberties Union or any other organization, is high and consistently high. I personally feared that we might see some drop off of interest. But I think there's a recognition among women that It's vitally important to be engaged.
Eliza, do you worry, though, that sometimes this engagement doesn't have a focus?
I've tried. I, of course, I worry about it. But I also have come to the recognition that there can be no one person who's in charge and that women need to act on what feels important to them. The advice that I gave at the Women's March in Augusta was find the one issue that's or the handful of issues that are vitally important to you. Figure out who else is out there working on them and find your people and get to work.
Yeah, well, if I could just piggyback on that. Yeah, I mean, I was at the Women's March in D.C., and it was just astounding. I'd been to other marches in D.C. I'd never seen anything like that before. It was just incredible. And I have been to, just about your comment about the unfocused nature of it, I do think people are paying attention. And I've been to a number of Planned Parenthood events that attract a lot of young people, young women as well as young men. And have been really gratified to see that their activism around that.
I'm going to go to Nicole, who's go ahead, Rhea. Go ahead. And Nicole, you hold on just a second. Rhea, go ahead.
I was just going to add to that in terms of diversity, when you're thinking of, you know, looking at the, you know, who is out there and the work that's being done. It's important to, I think, to avoid the stereotypes about the cultures or the diversities in that to have a deeper knowledge. And so, you know, you're having a language barrier maybe or challenges of, you know, conversation across, you know, who and what people, you know, represent. So if you're talking about representation of the women within the context, it's like, you know, if you're having a conversation, to me, it's always like who's not in the room is important.
Okay, Nicole, in Belfast, go ahead. You're on Main Calling.
Yeah, hi. Thank you so much, Jennifer, for doing the show on Main Calling. I really think there should be more shows focused on the issues that are being discussed. Hi to Rhea and Eliza as well. I'm just about to start teaching my Intro to Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies class here at the University of Maine. And I wanted to call attention to programs like this, to your listening audience, that we have these programs in the University of Maine system and colleges throughout the state where you can learn about things like women's history and suffrage and the ERA and feminism and equal pay. And my students here, what do you think about that?
Yeah. You're calling from class. You're really about to start teaching class.
I really am in like 3 minutes. So I just want to make sure that the readers or the listeners, I should say, know about programs like this, that they can take classes, enter into degree programs, their families can. And feminism is alive and well in higher education.
Well, Nicole, I invite
very,
you.
Very inspired by my students.
I invite you to, after class, post any information that would be helpful to our audience on our Main Calling Facebook page. Thank you so much for calling. We're going to, I think, get one more call in. We're going to go to Orland and Margaret. Hi, Margaret. Go ahead. You're on Main Calling.
Hi. I love your program, and it's stirred the cobwebs of my brain.
Oh, good.
I'm 84. But I remember my mother back in the day. She was quite a staunch activist with the League of Women Voters. And she always told me that she didn't look upon Mother's Day as being anything more than a trivializing of what the real Mother's Day was, which was a call to action back in the late 1800s as a result of the massacre of the war that went on in the Civil War and all of the young men that were just brutally destroyed. And she called on women and mothers to refuse to raise their young sons as warriors, to refuse to allow their husbands coming back from the war to enter their bedroom with their bloody hands. She was very graphic in this. And it was a call that was very different than how it's turned out to be now. My mother, you know, noted that now it's been trivialized. It's been taken over by financial interests that have made it a sentimental thing so that we'll buy something on Mother's Day and we'll send cards and then we'll go back to sleep. So that was fun to remember that.
Margaret, thank you so much for the history lesson. That's fascinating. Go ahead, Anne.
Yeah, I love that your mother did that because I've always told my kids and my husband that I refuse to get treated well just one day of the year. I want the other 364 as well.
And I think that this ties back to the question from the listener about women who vote against women's interests. It's about socialization. We live in a culture that celebrates the sort of mom and apple pie image of the mother who doesn't recognize how hard it is actually to have a baby and to raise children. We are still being shown a lot of movies in which women are fragile victims as opposed to being the lead character. Our advertising culture emphasizes women's looks and their bodies over their minds and their actions.
Okay, so I lied. I'm going to try to squeeze in one more. I'm going to go to Margie in Jonesboro. Hi, Margie. Go ahead.
Hi there. Hey, I just want to say one thing. You guys are great. And all the people on the planet are responsible from a woman. Can't they respect women and know that women have carried them for 9 months and then give birth to them? And you think men do that? Let's trade a little bit a while and let them see how that is. But at any rate, men are responsible for their seed, yes, but women are the ones that grow up the children and were responsible for everyone on the planet. And, you know, if it weren't for women, well, we wouldn't have anything but animals and everything else on the planet. We wouldn't have any people.
Margie, thanks for calling in. Aria, I want to give you a chance to talk before we run out of time. Go ahead.
I just wanted to go back to the comments about the mothers, but I think also to know, for my thing, I always say you can't deny the ancestors. So I think being able to know who you are in the public space is an important thing. And I think for the women of French heritage, to know that there are women out there like Camille and to know that we do have heroines. You know, and so to understand, our background and to be able to put that in the public space and be proud of that, that's important, I think, as well.
Well, thank you. Rhea Cody Robbins, the director of the Franco-American Women's Institute. Anne Gass is here in the studio with me, author of Voting Down the Rose, Florence Brooks, White House, and Maine's Fight for Women's Suffrage. Eliza Townsend, executive director of the Maine Women's Lobby. Thank you all three for being here today. John Keimel ran the board today. We had additional help from Rich Tozier. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as our audio archives at mainecalling.net. Today's show will be rebroadcast at 8. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, join me for a conversation about the latest news from our nation's capital. We'll be joined by three political science professors from different colleges and universities in Maine. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.